Hello and welcome to The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading this week from the August 16th through 22nd edition of The Economist. We'll begin as usual with The Leaders, a collection of five articles this week, chosen by Economist editors to represent the major events and themes of the week. The first is President Unpredictable, How to Win at Foreign Policy. And this, by the way, is the cover story. The short summary, Donald Trump's capricious deal-making destabilizes the world. Second will be Trade Restrictions versus Ingenuity. Xi Jinping's weaponization of rare earth elements will ultimately backfire. Subheading, How the West Can Break China's Grip on These Vital Minerals. Third, Defense in the Pacific. America and its Asian allies need to spend more to deter China. Subheading, It Should Be a Two-Way Street. Fourth, Climate Tipping Points. The shutdown of ocean currents could freeze Europe. Subheading, When Climate Change Poses a Strategic Threat, It Needs a Strategic Response. Fifth, and finally, Racial Justice, Why South Africa Should Scrap Black Economic Empowerment. Subheading, The Ruling Party's Flagship Policy is a Cause of the Country's Problems, Not a Solution. Following the reading of those five leaders' articles, we'll turn to the main section of the magazine, and as time allows, cover articles from the United States, the Americas, Asia, China, Middle East and Africa, Europe, and Britain. So, turning now to that first leaders article, and again, this is the cover story this week. We have the title, President Unpredictable, How to Win at Foreign Policy. Subheading, Donald Trump's capricious deal-making destabilizes the world. When Donald Trump meets Vladimir Putin in Alaska, it will be the seventh time the two have talked in person. This time is different, though. Since their last sit-down, Mr. Putin has launched an unprovoked war, lost perhaps a million Russian soldiers dead and wounded, and inflicted ceaseless misery on Ukrainians in pursuit of an imperial dream. Undaunted, Mr. Trump hopes to get in a room with a wily dictator, feel him out, and forge a deal. It's the biggest test yet of his uniquely personal style of diplomacy. It's also a reminder of how unpredictable American foreign policy has become. Will Mr. Trump be firm, making clear that America and its allies will do what it takes to guarantee Ukraine's sovereignty? Or will he be in such a rush to reopen business with Russia that he rewards its aggression and leaves Ukraine vulnerable to future attacks? As everyone clamors for the president's ears, no one knows what he will do. At the beginning of Mr. Trump's second term, his supporters had a theory about how he would wield American power. Rather than relying on deep relationships and experience, he would rely on his gut. As a master negotiator with a knack for sensing what others want and fear, he would cut through the waffle and apply pressure ruthlessly. Everyone wants access to American markets. By threatening to shut them out, he would force recalcitrant foreigners to end wars and reset the terms of trade to America's advantage. Career diplomats and experts would be replaced by rainmakers. Yes, his transactional approach might foster a bit of corruption, but if it brought peace in Ukraine or Gaza, who cared? Alas, there are drawbacks to this approach. Using tariffs as a weapon hurts America too. More fundamentally, junking universal principles for might makes right repels friends without necessarily cowing foes, and the substitution of presidential whim for any coherent theory of international relations makes geopolitics less predictable and more dangerous. Mr. Trump is not a globalist, obviously, nor is he an isolationist or a believer in regional spheres of influence. He simply does what he wants, which changes frequently. One way to make sense of Trumpism is that he divides his efforts at deal-making into three categories, high, medium, and low stakes. In the first category are America's relations with unfriendly great powers, principally China and Russia. Israel's here too because of its importance in American domestic politics. Iran makes an appearance because of the way it threatens its neighbors. Now, all these relationships are complex, difficult, and matter a lot to Mr. Trump. If he scores a win here, if he ends the war in Ukraine, or brings peace between Israel and the Palestinians, or finds a formula for cooperating with China without endangering national security, then the payoff is potentially staggering. In the medium stakes category, Mr. Trump puts Brazil, South Africa, and oddly, giant India. These are important countries that both America and China want in their camp. In most cases, their values are far closer to America's than China's. Ties with them ought to be win-win. But they're unwilling to be bossed around and take offense when Mr. Trump insults or tries to bully them. The small stakes for Mr. Trump are in small or poor countries. A superpower can wield great influence over such places, sometimes to good ends. Mr. Trump helped cement a peace deal between Azerbaijan and Armenia, for example, and brokered a truce between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. These are welcome achievements. Azerbaijan and Armenia have been fighting for 35 years. Mr. Trump mediated a reopening of trade and transport links. The fruits may include a weakening of Russian influence in the area. The Congo-Rwanda deal is much shakier. Rwandan-backed rebels have violated it repeatedly, but not nothing. And there may be an upside for America in the form of mineral deals. When it comes to medium-sized stakes, Mr. Trump's method works less well. He started needless feuds with the leaders of Brazil because it's prosecuting a Trumpy ex-president for allegedly attempting a coup, with South Africa because he believes wrongly that it's persecuting whites, and with India, infuriating its prime minister with painful tariffs and undiplomatic boasting. The result? India will draw closer to Russia again and be less inclined to act as a counterweight against China, Brazil, and South Africa. And they see China as a more reliable partner than America. Mr. Trump has won headlines that play well with his most ardent supporters, but America has lost out. And when it comes to the highest stakes, the president is floundering. He's tried to coerce China with tariffs, but it's fighting back. This week, Mr. Trump blinked and extended another deadline. He also undermined his own national security policy by lifting a ban on exports of NVIDIA chips to China while insisting that Uncle Sam gets a 15% cut. On Ukraine, he's been wildly inconsistent, one day blaming it for having been invaded and threatening to cut military aid, and then accusing Mr. Putin of bad faith and threatening stiffer sanctions on Russia. On Israel, he's consistently given Benjamin Netanyahu everything he wants and extracted nothing in return. If Mr. Trump's bombing of Iran's nuclear sites made Israel cipher, well and good, but he's failed to use his leverage to restrain Israel's unending war in Gaza. The world is flattery. Other countries are learning how to play Mr. Trump. A crypto deal and a nomination for a Nobel Peace Prize worked for Pakistan. A plane helped Qatar. The corruption is turning out to be as bad as almost everyone feared. The great deals have yet to materialize. Those who say Mr. Trump is looking out for his own interests, not America's, have plenty of ammunition. All this is only a preliminary judgment. If Mr. Trump stands up to Mr. Putin this week, perhaps he can make his greatest ever deal, ending Europe's worst war since 1945. Sadly, the odds are against it. And our second leader's article is titled Trade Restrictions versus Ingenuity. Xi Jinping's weaponization of rare earth elements will ultimately backfire. And the subheading, How the West Can Break China's Grip on These Vital Minerals. Soon after the blockade started, the panic began. When China choked off the export of rare earth elements in April, producers and politicians around the world were quick to sound the alarm. China provides over 90% of the world's supply of refined rare earths, which are used to make strong magnets inside almost anything with an electric motor, from vacuum cleaners to cars, and which also appear in high-tech products from smartphones to fighter jets. Some car makers curtailed production. The industry's in panic mode, said one boss. Ursula von der Leyen, head of the European Commission, thundered against China's dominance and blackmail. At first glance, the use of rare earths as a weapon is working, and Xi Jinping, China's president, is getting what he wants. After the flow of rare earth resumed, America's president lifted controls on the sale of some NVIDIA chips and delayed a hefty increase in import duties. On August 11th, America and China further extended their trade truce. In July, Mrs. von der Leyen went cap in hand to Beijing, seeking looser restrictions. But in the long term, China's rare earths weapon will backfire. The new controls are a sign of just how sophisticated China's economic arsenal has become. After a political spat in 2010, it briefly blocked the export of rare earths to Japan. In a fit of pique in 2020, it increased duties on Australian Shiraz and grass-fed beef. Now, however, Mr. Xi has put in place a system of export controls that seek to exploit China's heft in global supply chain. A licensing scheme covering more than 700 goods, including manufactured equipment and critical minerals, began operating in December. Officials keep careful track of the ultimate consumer of the products and can revoke licenses. Even though rare earth exports have resumed in recent weeks, sales to Western arms makers, for instance, are still choked off. The aim is clear. Mr. Xi wants to indigenize supply chains so that China is not at the mercy of its enemies for critical inputs, an effort that was turbocharged after America banned the export of advanced chips to China. He also hopes to use China's control of supply chains as a source of power over others. As long ago as April of 2020, he told officials that dependency on China could be a deterrent against foreigners who would, quote, artificially cut off supply, end quote. The difficulty for Mr. Xi, though, is that export controls have unintended consequences. Confronted with a ban, companies and entrepreneurs find ways around the shortage. China's dominance in rare earths stems not from exclusive control of the world's deposits, nor from the technological sophistication of the refining process, but instead from efficiency and scale. And the more it uses rare earths, or indeed other commodities, as a weapon, the more it will encourage others to find alternatives, weakening its future firepower. Start with the nature of China's chokehold. Despite their name, rare earths are relatively abundant. Less than half of all known reserves are found in China. Refining is a painstaking and polluting business, but not as technologically complex as advanced chip making. China's grip on rare earths is therefore not as strong as the West's on cutting-edge chips and easier to work around. Indeed, until the 1980s, America was the biggest supplier of the minerals. The dominance of China came about because it was more willing to accept the environmental consequences and has since been cemented by its gargantuan size, which allows rare earths to be mined cheaply. Efforts by China to restrict the flow of rare earths have already spurred efforts to find alternatives. After the spat in 2010, Japan invested in rare earth mines and began building stockpiles. Although it still imports rare earths from China, its dependence has fallen from 90% to 60%. Earlier this year, the Pentagon took a stake in MP Minerals, a miner in California with which Apple has signed a deal. All told, 22 new mining projects are expected to be up and running by 2030. Trendy geoeconomic theory points out that even a small erosion of China's dominance in rare earths could weaken its power disproportionately. Reducing its share from 90% to 80% may not sound like much, but it would imply a doubling in size of alternative sources of supply, giving China's customers far more room for maneuver. Even so, this diversification could still take years. What could Western governments do to speed it up? They have a responsibility, of course, to secure their military supply chains. They could also streamline the process by approving mineral permits, which in America can take up to a decade, and could revisit environmental rules. Lowering trade barriers would also help the rest of the world mimic China's scale. It would be a mistake, though, for governments to seek to protect the entire economy from the impact of shortages. That is because a far more powerful and underappreciated response to shortages is innovation. Just think how America's chip controls have prompted Chinese firms such as Huawei and DeepSeek to develop new techniques, or how a cobalt crunch in 2022 quickly eased, partly as makers of electric vehicles sound ways to do without the metal. Similarly, startups across the West are now working on the recycling of rare earths and on the development of alternative ways to make magnets and motors that do not rely on them. BMW and Renault, two European car makers, already sell electric vehicles that do not use rare earths in their motors. Other companies could follow suit, and China's restrictions will cause disruption as producers rejig their processes, but long-term alternatives do exist. From rare to overcooked. The more China uses its rare earths weapon, therefore, the weaker it will become. Time and again, enterprise and ingenuity have prevailed over attempts to control the flow of goods. China itself learned that lesson as its technology firms responded to America's export controls on chips. It may have to learn it again. And our third leader's article is titled Defense in the Pacific. America and its Asian allies need to spend more to deter China. Subheading, it should be a two-way street. Unlike in Europe or the Middle East, there are no big interstate wars taking place in Asia right now, but the threat from China's military buildup is obvious. Across the Pacific, American airmen are busy restoring and upgrading Second World War air bases so that they can be used by their forces today. This is part of a policy to deter China that began under President Joe Biden. Now President Donald Trump is demanding that America's Asian friends contribute far more to this task. The administration wants them to spend more on defense and do more to deter an attack on Taiwan. Yet Mr. Trump has sown doubts about America's commitments to its friends, most spectacularly with Ukraine and NATO, but also with India. What should America's Asian partners do? Europe could plausibly defend itself without copious American help against Russia, but America's Asian friends would have little chance of deterring China if they were abandoned by Uncle Sam unless they resorted to nuclear weapons. China's relative advantage is larger, the geography is daunting, and there is no Asian alliance comparable to NATO. Yet fortunately, the Trump administration's commitment to the Pacific is deeper than to Europe. Its Asian partners should build on that. A lack of cash is a problem. Mr. Trump's big beautiful bill passed last month. It will provide an injection of funds for America's armed forces, but his budget request for the next fiscal year is flat, implying a cut after inflation. Congress needs to spend more if the Pentagon is to keep up with technological change and have enough ships, airfields, troops, and munitions to counter China. Among America's five main security partners in the region, Australia, Japan, Philippines, South Korea, and Taiwan, average annual defense spending is a threadbare 1.8% of GDP. Mr. Trump is right to ask them to spend 3.5% on defense. Australia, South Korea, and Taiwan have low public debt compared with other rich countries and could afford to do more. Australia's Labor government, for example, has no excuse. Its own white papers warn of the seriousness of the threat from China, but its defense budget at just under 2% of GDP tells a different story. It should put off planned tax cuts and new social programs or use debt financing to commit to meeting the new target. In Japan, tough decisions loom. A minority liberal Democratic Party government is under pressure to offer tax cuts, not a jump in defense spending. With high debt, borrowing to pay for defense is harder. Across the region, the Pentagon should be careful about these conversations, however. Pushing too hard for unpopular policies could create a backlash among voters. Even as they raise spending, America's Asian partners should do more together, not least by investing more in the region's defense industrial base. This would helpfully place arms factories closer to where weapons might be needed. It would also create a modest hedge against American abandonment. Australia's recent announcement that it would buy frigates from Japan is a start. By lifting their own spending and beefing up their industrial bases, they can protect themselves, show America they're not freeloading, and build confidence that China can be deterred in the Pacific. And our fourth leader's article is titled Climate Tipping Points. The shutdown of ocean currents could freeze Europe. Subheading, when climate change poses a strategic threat, it needs a strategic response. Those who think about national security love to bandy acronyms such as ATACMS, A-T-A-C-M-S, which stands for Army Tactical Missile System, and WOMBAT, Weapon of Magnesium Battalion Anti-Tank. They should add AMOC to the list, A-M-O-C, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. It's not a weapon system, but it could lay waste a continent, specifically Europe, to an extent only a nuclear war could outmatch. AMOC, A-M-O-C, is part of a system of currents which move heat around the oceans of the world. It delivers a stupendous flow of heat, more than 1,000 terawatts, to the North Atlantic. That sounds like the sort of planetary juggernaut it would be incredibly hard for humans, whose global civilization runs at a mere 20 terawatts, to do anything about. Alas, no. AMOC is a curiously delicate thing. Changes in sea surface temperature and salinity caused by global warming could conceivably make it stall. Such abrupt shutdowns are clearly visible in the geological record. For Europe, it could mean a sudden severe cooling, even as the rest of the world keeps warming. Europeans sweltering through yet another summer heat wave might think such cooling would be just the ticket. Again, alas, no. A complete AMOC shutdown could see Brussels hitting minus 20 degrees centigrade, that is minus 4 Fahrenheit, in a bad winter. In Oslo, the figure would be almost minus 50 degrees centigrade, or minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit. Not quite Yakutsk, but not far off. February sea ice in the North Sea could come as far south as the Humber Estuary and the Frisian Islands north of Holland. Average rainfall in parts of northern Europe would drop precipitously, according to one estimate, as much as 80% of Europe's arable land would no longer be farmable without irrigation. Storms would get worse, so in some models might summer heat waves. That would be the worst of all worlds. And it's not just Europe. By cooling the northern hemisphere as a whole, an AMOC collapse would push the band of rain which girdles the tropics toward the south. That would be very bad for the African countries on the south edge of the Sahara. It could also be devastating to the Amazon. Cold, dry, and sudden. These ghastly prospects are one of the reasons that AMOC takes a starring role in worries about climate tipping points, effects of warming that might be dramatic, damaging, and irreversible. Another reason is the strong suggestion in theory and models that after a currently unknown temperature threshold is passed, the collapse could take just a few decades. A third is that AMOC, or at least parts of it, may already be in slow decline. This is well known to people who think about climate change, as is the level of uncertainty about how far away the threshold actually is, and the spirited debate over how complete a collapse might ensue. But there's no evidence that such possibilities are feeding into government planning processes. You might argue that they shouldn't, that the response to the risk should be to redouble all efforts, which might keep the temperature low enough to avoid a tipping point, but preparedness makes sense. The Advanced Research and Invention Agency in Britain is funding prototype monitoring schemes that might make possible early warnings of accelerating collapse. If it could be made robust enough, such a system could make possible years of preparation. If this were a military threat, such risk reduction would be second nature, as would tabletop analysis of vulnerabilities and contingency plans for softening impacts. Larger outlays are not, as yet, necessary. But larger imaginations are. And our fifth and final leader's article is titled Racial Justice: Why South Africa Should Scrap Black Economic Empowerment. The subheading is, The ruling party's flagship policy is a cause of the country's problems, not a solution. Some months after Nelson Mandela was released from prison in February of 1990, he told businesses that South Africa must, quote, de-racialize the exercise of economic power, end quote. Such words unnerved the conglomerates that had prospered under apartheid. Mandela's African National Congress then thought that nationalizing industries was the best way to uplift black South Africans. To help convince the ANC of the merits of capitalism before it won power in South Africa's first all-race election of 1994, the firms proposed empowerment deals. Instead, discounted assets were sold to members of the new elite, including Cyril Ramaphosa, today one of South Africa's richest men and its president. What began as ad hoc inducements has become the most far-reaching state-sponsored attempt at racial redress in the world. Black Economic Empowerment, BEE, requires firms, in effect, to have a minimum share of black investors, to hire and train black staff, and to buy from black-owned suppliers. Despite criticism of BEE from President Donald Trump, who cites it to justify 30% tariffs on South Africa, Mr. Ramaphosa has called it, quote, not just a policy choice, but a constitutional imperative, end quote. He said there is no trade-off between racial transformation and economic growth. While Mr. Ramaphosa is wrong, a policy that made him rich is making his country poorer. It should be scrapped. BEE is meant to reduce South Africa's stratospheric levels of inequality, but the main beneficiaries have been a tiny group of new landlords. By one conservative estimate, around 1 trillion rand, that's more than $50 billion at today's rates, has been transferred to fewer than 100 people, many of them returning again and again to strike BEE deals. This is oligopoly, not equality. Under the ANC, inequality between black South Africans has exploded. The top 10% of black earners have seen incomes more than triple. Those of the bottom 50% have fallen slightly. This is mostly because of high joblessness, which reflects persistently low growth. One reason is BEE, meeting ownership requirements and paying extortionate transaction costs, is an inefficient use of capital. De facto quotas reduce productivity, forcing firms to buy from black suppliers, even if they're more expensive, squeezes profits. A recent estimate puts the cost of complying with BEE at 145 to 290 billion rand per year, or 2 to 4% of GDP. This explains why South Africa is last for ease of doing business on a list of 49 countries compiled by the World Bank. Larger firms can more easily pay for consultants that advise on BEE, shielding them from competition. The policy repels foreign investment. It also discourages genuine black entrepreneurship. Why start a firm when you could get a piece of someone else's? All this explains why the rate at which firms enter and exit the market is one-third of that of other middle-income states, and worse, B begets graft. When the state must procure based on race, not cost, it makes deals with cronies easier. Supporters of B say that scrapping it's impractical, and even if that were true, the government could stop it from getting worse, for instance, by ditching plans for a 100 billion rand state-run transformation fund paid for by a tax on firms. They also argue that abolishing B would prevent dealing with the sins of the past, but to improve the lot of poor South Africans, it would be better to focus specifically on poverty, not race. Since the vast majority of the poor are black people, they would be the main beneficiaries of pro-poor policies. There is an argument that the elite bargain of the 1990s helped keep the peace in a fractious country, but today it aggravates social tensions by fostering inequality and keeping the salience of race high. In a large poll this year, pluralities of South Africans, including black South Africans, said that B reduces economic growth and is, quote, outdated and divisive, end quote. Mr. Ramaphosa should take these views seriously. It's becoming ever clearer that B is not the solution to South Africa's problem. but a cause of them. And just before the halfway mark in today's broadcast, we remind you, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading from the August 16 through 22 edition of The Economist. And turning now to the main section of the magazine, we begin as usual with a lead article on the United States. This one is titled, A Capital Offensive: Why Donald Trump is Wrong to Take Over the D.C. Police. Subheading, The Emergency, he cites, is overhyped. America's capital city was designed as a showcase for its democracy. Sweeping boulevards, white marble palaces of administration, monuments aplenty. Over the past few days, however, Washington, D.C. has become a manifestation of something less inspiring, the grandstanding instincts of the current president. This time, Donald Trump's preoccupation is violent crime. Mr. Trump has been banging his drum for decades. Quote, roving bands of wild criminals roam our neighborhoods dispensing their own brand of twisted hatred, end quote. So warned Mr. Trump nearly 40 years ago. The occasion was the rape and assault of a white woman in New York Central Park, for which five black and Hispanic men were later wrongfully convicted. On August 11th, Mr. Trump all but quoted himself, quote, our capital city has been overtaken by violent gangs and bloodthirsty criminals, roving mobs of wild youth, drugged out maniacs, and homeless people, end quote. He said this from the White House briefing room. Then he deployed the National Guard to Washington, took control of its police force, and promised, quote, to get rid of the slums, end quote, and clear out its homeless population. This is not the president's first use of armed forces for civilian law enforcement in a city that reviles him, and that he reviles right back. Earlier this summer, Mr. Trump sent National Guard troops to protect federal property during protests over immigration raids in Los Angeles. In 2020, he ordered them to disperse Black Lives Matter demonstrators in Washington. In neither instance did local Democratic leaders ask for his intervention. Now, Mr. Trump hints that the Washington deployment could be a blueprint for other troublesome, that is, Democratic, places. That's Democratic with capital D. Every other blue city mayor should take note, said Rick Scott, a Republican senator. Democrats agree, describing Washington as a dress rehearsal. That will be easier said than done. The Capitol has an unusual legal status as a territory of the federal government, granted qualified home rule. Elsewhere, the president would face more legal impediments. The practical impact of his order may also be modest. He has authorized the D.C. Guard, which is tiny, to act as cops. About 200 troops will support law enforcement. Mr. Trump's control of the city police can only last. He says he will seek an extension from Congress, which is unlikely to oblige. This is a long way from a federal takeover of Washington. It's still absurd. Seeking to justify his order, Mr. Trump cited several awful attacks against government workers. In early August, carjackers beat up and bloodied a former Doge staffer. In June, stray gunfire killed a congressional intern. Last year, an official at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission was shot to death in a carjacking. In 2023, a Senate aide was stabbed and a congressman was robbed at gunpoint. Quote, it's becoming a situation of complete and total lawlessness, end quote. So said Mr. Trump, likening the Capitol to Baghdad or Bogota. The president is right that violent crime in Washington surged in 2023 and it numbers among the more dangerous cities in America. He neglected to say that crime there has since tumbled. This year's murder rate is falling towards the pre-pandemic trend. The number of carjackings, which doubled between 2022 and 2023, is declining too, though they're still more frequent than they were before the pandemic. Overall, the Capitol is much safer than it was in the 1990s, when it had the highest murder rate in the country, and is a bit less dangerous than it was a decade ago, notes Jeffrey Asher, a crime analyst. If Mr. Trump and his fellow Republicans were really concerned about public safety in the city, they would not have put D.C. in an unnecessary fiscal straitjacket. Congress has sweeping powers over the city's finances, and earlier this year, Republicans used them to force it to slash spending, even though its budget was already balanced, unlike the federal government's. That has made it impossible for the city to increase spending on the police or anything else. It has money sitting in the bank that Congress will not allow it to spend. It is defund the police, Republican style. Mr. Trump's has a fixation with Washington, the city, and not just because he can see it from his bedroom window. The Constitution gives the federal government authority to run the city directly. It has much less power over states and even other federal territories. The president commands the D.C. National Guard. In states, governors have that job, and he can take temporary control of the police department. Washington's unique status means these same tactics cannot easily be replicated outside the Capitol. To federalize the National Guard for arrest purposes elsewhere, to empower troops to act as cops, Mr. Trump would have to invoke the Insurrection Act. Only then can the armed forces legally be put to use to quell a domestic uprising. The act was last used in 1992. Invoking it again would be immensely controversial. Before Mr. Trump, the last president to deploy the Guard over the objections of a governor was Lyndon Johnson during civil rights demonstrations in Selma, Alabama. Army officials tend to dislike the idea of getting involved in law enforcement, with good reason. The training and rules of engagement are different. Battlefields require a mindset primed for combat. As it is, Mr. Trump's prior National Guard deployments have been legally fraught. The federal district judge in California is currently weighing whether his use of the Guard there flouted the narrow scope allowed in that instance, where they were only meant to protect buildings. Mr. Trump's decision to send other states' Guard units to Washington in 2020 was even more tenuous from a legal perspective, said Mark Nevitt, a law professor at Emory University. Washington's 700,000-odd residents have little recourse to resist Mr. Trump's actions. They do not get any votes in Congress. Although the federal government did grant them an elected mayor and city council in the 1970s, it could rescind that home rule at any time. Mr. Trump has threatened to do so several times. Local politicians, for the most part, are trying to ward off such a possibility by placating him. Mr. Trump's approach in Washington, then, is clever when viewed through a politician's or a lawyer's lens, which is not to say that his order is justified or good policy. And turning next to the section on Asia, we have an article titled Weapons and Words, America's Biggest Ask in Asia. Subheading, Eldridge Colby and Others Push Allies to Ramp Up Defense Spending. Despite wars in Europe and the Middle East, the Pentagon's top strategists have recently been focused on Asia. Having got members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, to promise to spend 3.5% of their GDP on defense and a further 1.5% of GDP on defense-related infrastructure, they have now turned the budgets of Asian allies. The European formula, they say, is the new global standard. That would imply a massive increase in defense budgets from Sapporo to Sydney. To hit 3.5% would add over $150 billion per year in defense spending, the biggest rise among allies in the Pacific in 50 years. America's demands also prompts three questions. What is the right budget level? And how should allies spend the money, and how will they comply? Of America's five big security partners in the region, Australia, Japan, the Philippines, South Korea, and Taiwan, discussions with Australia and Japan appear to be the most advanced. They have been told that they should meet targets of 3.5% of GDP, and quickly. When asked about the talks, Australian and Japanese officials show flashes of quiet anger. America has overstepped the mark, they say, by dictating sovereign budgetary decisions. And despite talk of a global standard, Donald Trump's administration has suggested other figures as well. The Philippines and South Korea have been told that they should be prepared to match other allies, but appear to be under less pressure. South Korea already spends 2.5% of GDP on defense, the highest of the five, while the much poorer Philippines spend the least and would struggle to hit that 3.5%. At the other end of the spectrum, Mr. Trump has long said that Taiwan should spend 10% of GDP on defense. Taiwan is not a formal treaty ally. Leading these conversations is the Pentagon's third-ranking official, Eldridge Colby. He's perhaps the most talked-about appointee to the role of Undersecretary for Policy in a generation. His backers include J.D. Vance, the vice president who introduced Mr. Colby in glowing terms at his confirmation hearing in March, an extraordinary gesture of support. When speaking of America's demands, allied officials talk of what Bridge wants as often as what the Trump administration wants. Some defense wonks question Mr. Colby's focus on top-line numbers. It often takes years for budget increases to translate into new weapon systems or combat formations. By the time they can make a difference, it might be too late to deter China. Better instead to have conversations about how to better integrate allies into existing war plans. But those have been made more difficult by the way that demands to increase defense spending are souring relations between allies. In June, Japan reportedly canceled an annual meeting of its foreign and defense ministers with their American counterparts, in part because the Pentagon bid up its ass from 3 to 3.5%. One Pentagon official involved in the effort says that relations are fine, but admits, quote, "Some of these conversations can be challenging because they did not take place during the Biden administration, and so our allies and our partners are having these conversations for the first time," end quote. An increase in defense spending is not the only request that America is making of these countries. Australia has been asked to commit to joining America in any defense that it might mount of Taiwan. Japan has been pressed for more clarity over how it would respond in such a situation. The Philippines has been asked to support the deployment of new weapons on its territory. South Korea and Japan have been asked to pay more for the privilege of hosting American forces. For its part, Taiwan is under pressure to spend less on fancy high-tech weaponry like fighter jets and tanks, and more on smaller, more mobile forces that would make it hard for China to occupy the island. Allies fear that America might abandon them. The worry that Mr. Trump may do a deal with President Xi Jinping that leaves them to face China alone. Australian officials are anxious that America could get the AUKUS submarine building pact. A bridge too far? Even so, unlike in Europe, where America's allies have given serious thought to de-risking their defense industrial base against the possibility of American abandonment, Asian allies have not hedged. Their reasons are pragmatic, whereas strategic autonomy in Europe may be possible, if not cheap. For Asian allies, it's out of reach. None is a nuclear power, so all depend on America's nuclear umbrella. Of the five, South Korea has the biggest defense industry, and Japan has made strides toward reviving its own. But the defense industrial bases are small compared with Europe's, and the allies are looking at buying more American military gear, not less. All five countries protest they are already increasing defense spending but can't hit the Trump administration's new targets because of fiscal constraints. Spending even more on defense, they argue, will require them either to put up taxes or cut social outlays. But this is really only true of Japan and the Philippines, which have high levels of public debt relative to their resources and would struggle to finance any new big expenditures. By contrast, Australia, South Korea, and Taiwan have fiscal positions similar to or better than the median NATO member. Scars from the Asian financial crisis of a quarter century ago have made them frugal. They worry about the liabilities of aging populations, high levels of private debt, and keeping their credit investment grade, but they could probably afford to debt finance any increase to 3.5% into at least the late 2030s without raising taxes, cutting spending, or going into debt distress. Taiwan's fiscal position is perhaps the best. Moreover, says Drew Thompson, who managed defense relations with Taiwan under Barack Obama and in Mr. Trump's first term, quote, "butter has won out over guns," end quote. He points to the island's excellent education and healthcare. Yet Taiwan faces an existential threat from China. In these circumstances, it should be able to afford to spend another 2% of GDP on defense, on top of the 3% that President Lai Ching-te has requested for the next fiscal year. Political constraints play a bigger role. In Taiwan, the opposition controls the legislature and fears that higher defense spending will antagonize China. In Japan, an unpopular minority government is facing down a resurgent opposition calling for tax cuts. And in Australia, the Labor government wants to squeeze through some big new social programs while keeping its reputation for fiscal prudence. Experts and officials on both sides of the Pacific think that America is likely to get some but not all of what it asks for. A bigger risk is that America's tactics will backfire. Mr. Trump polls poorly in Australia, said Anthony Albanese, its present prime minister, and seems tempted to profit politically by standing up to him. In the other four countries, Mr. Trump is a bit more popular, but forcing governments to spend more on defense would not be. The Pentagon dismisses these concerns. Allies could, quote, leave themselves vulnerable to Beijing, and that would evidently not be in their interest, end quote. So says another Pentagon official, and he may be right. But America's allies will still bristle at being bossed around. And turning next to the section on the Middle East and Africa, we have a title, The War in Gaza, The World's Hardest Makeover, Hamas. Subheading, Dissent Against It Builds Inside and Outside the Strip. It was born as the Islamic Resistance Movement. It is more usually known by its Arabic acronym Hamas. But talks taking place in Cairo could determine whether the Palestinian militants drop the middle word, abandon their 22-month war in Gaza against Israel, and reinvent themselves as a political party. On August 12th, Khalil al-Hayya, the head of Hamas's Gazan wing, arrived in Cairo for negotiations mediated by Egypt with Qatar and Turkey. On the table is a proposal to decommission its weapons, dissolve its armed brigades, free the remaining hostages, and surrender power. In exchange, Israel would withdraw from Gaza. An interim Palestinian technocratic administration would be put in place, supported by a UN-endorsed international force, and the rebuilding of the devastated territory would begin. The external pressure on Mr. Hayya to accept such a deal is intense. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is threatening to occupy the whole of Gaza. On August 12th, Israeli forces began heavy strikes on Gaza City. Another offensive could destroy what remains of Hamas there and hasten the ethnic cleansing of the entire strip. The weakening of Iran has stripped the group's armed wing, the Ezin al-Qassam Brigades, of its main foreign backer. Hamas's last regional backers, Qatar and Turkey, have long favored the group's political arm, but they seem to be losing patience. They're understood to have said that if Mr. Hayya refuses a deal, they might refuse to allow him and Hamas's other leaders, who all left Doha a fortnight ago, to return. Hamas faces even more pressure from those on whose behalf it claims to fight. The movement was born in Gaza, but the population that propelled it to victory in elections 2 decades ago has turned on the group. Few see value in a resistance that invites devastation upon them, while its fighters shelter in tunnels and politicians negotiate over the width of a buffer zone. Around 100 Gazans were killed each day in July, nearly all by Israel. Threats of reprisals no longer mute criticism. People in Gaza are just furious with Hamas, says a journalist from Gaza, now in exile in Qatar. They just want the nightmare to end, he says. A political activist in Gaza blames Hamas for the famine. Quote, Hamas's insistence on keeping power gives Israel the pretext to starve us, end quote. Again quoting, Hamas should dissolve and disappear, end quote. Dissent is even spilling through Hamas's ranks. On WhatsApp groups, some members are calling for a laying down of arms before Gaza suffers even more. Others in Hamas envision the group becoming a political party in the manner of Northern Ireland's Sinn Féin, or Israel's own legal Islamist party, the United Arab List. Justice and Development, one suggests calling it. Reimagined, it could agree to the conditions set by the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas for participation in recently announced Palestinian elections. They include endorsing a two-state settlement, negotiations with Israel, and Mr. Abbas's demand for a monopoly on Palestinian weapons. Given the disenchantment with Fatah, his own lackluster movement, and the admiration Hamas's grit still attracts outside Gaza, they might even win. It's been months since I've been this optimistic, said an advisor to the movement exiled from Gaza. And yet, in Gaza City, the brigades fight on. Apart from cobbling shoes out of wood and rubber, it's one of the last opportunities Gaza still offers. America's, or rather Israel's, attacks may have decimated Hamas's ranks, but they still have weapons to harry their foe. Their presence spared Gaza even worse atrocities, they say, implausibly. Quote, without the Qassam brigades, we would have had hundreds of Sabras and Shatilas, argued the exiled son of a slain military commander, referring to the slaughter of thousands of Palestinian refugees in Israeli-occupied Beirut in 1982. Many think they could regain power in Gaza. Asked to describe the Qassam brigade's mood, a Palestinian interlocutor with Hamas adopts an Irish lilt. No surrender, he says. Meanwhile, in exile, Hamas's leaders reckon that Israel may be winning the battles, but is losing the war. As in Algeria's War of Independence, their reading is that the resistance has turned the enemy's weapons against itself, exhausting the Israelis and draining them of their international legitimacy and moral authority. Far from ending the conflict, they argue, a mass exodus of Palestinians from Gaza would intensify it. Algeria won independence only after a million Algerians had lost their lives. Be patient, Gaza, said Ghazi Hamad, a senior member of Hamas. How can Hamas be pushed to accept a deal? A commitment, if given by a new Arab committee overseeing its implementation, to integrate tens of thousands of Hamas's civil servants into a new Palestinian administration and perhaps some fighters into the security forces might help. Hamas's political leaders have expressed readiness to hand over their weapons to a new Palestinian administration in Gaza once Israel fully withdraws. The brigades will accept the movement's decision, says a strategist close to Hamas in Istanbul. But many obstacles remain. America and Israel must also accept the terms, and neither has come to Cairo. Despite the rising costs for Israel, Mr. Netanyahu still prefers military to diplomatic endgames. The details of Hamas's disarmament, any international force, and an interim technocratic Palestinian government have yet to be determined, says an Egyptian observer, and Hamas's pragmatism has only ever gone so far. In 1991, after the end of the First Palestinian Intifada and the start of direct Israeli-Palestinian talks, one of Hamas's founders declared mission accomplished. He proposed disbanding Hamas's armed wing and joining the negotiations. How long can we forgo our brand recognition? Retorted his brothers. Too many within Hamas may still feel the same. And turning now to the section on Britain, we have an article titled Game Changing. Britain is a global gaming superpower. Can it remain one? The arrival of Grand Theft Auto 6 in 2026 will be less a video game release than a cultural moment. The game, which has players stealing cars, selling drugs, and killing cops, will have cost upward of $2 billion to build, yet it almost certainly will turn a profit within its first week. With its glitzy cityscapes, radio soundtrack, and trademark swagger, the series looks, sounds, and feels like a warped parody of America. Yet this blockbuster began its life in the small Scottish city of Dundee and is still made by a team of tartan nerds in Edinburgh, a feat celebrated in the British government's strategy for the creative industries, and is released in June. Such recognition is overdue. Gaming has long been a British superpower. The industry generates annual revenues of some $200 billion globally. Strip out the Cayman Islands, a British overseas territory, and Britain is the third largest exporter of video games, behind only America and Japan. Understated and quirky, it often plays the role of incubator. Tomb Raider, a billion-dollar franchise with its own Netflix series, began as a sketch in Derby. Recent successes include Fall Guys, a battle royal, Obstacle Course, Little Big Planet, a pioneer in user-generated content, and Total War Warhammer, based on the tabletop series. In Britain, video games generate more revenue, £4.3 billion, than the film, excluding streaming, and music industries combined at £3.4 billion. Not everyone is convinced that Britain should be as supportive of its gaming industry as of, say, its life sciences. Outdated stereotypes that gaming turns youths into obese oddballs or school shooters still prevail in parts of Westminster. Others fret about the future, with investment slowing and artificial intelligence looming. The global gaming industry is in turmoil. Such pessimism is misguided, as in other creative industries, from film to fashion. British ingenuity makes it well-placed to thrive in an age of same-ish IA, or rather AI. To understand Britain's unique role in the global gaming industry, go back to its origins. In the early 1980s, cheap programmable home computers gave rise to a generation of bedroom coders. The grassroots mix of creativity and code stood in contrast with America and Japan, where console-driven markets and not PC games took off first. Britain's offbeat scene spawned hits with cultish fan bases such as Broken Sword, a mystery adventure starring an American puzzle solver. This soon attracted the attention of industry giants. In 1997, Dundee's Abertray University launched the world's first computer game degree. Britain's also good at making mobile games, which are more accessible and cheaper to create than console blockbusters. Golf Clash, the top-grossing sports mobile game in America in 2021, was made in less than a year by around 20 people in a leafy town in Cheshire. Triple Dot Studios, popular for its solitaire games, based in London. In June, it bought the mobile games arm of AppLovin, a NASDAQ-listed tech firm, for $800 million. As the industry has grown, with exports increasing from $3.4 billion in 2016 to $8.8 billion in 2021, its benefits have become more evident. Those are dollar figures, by the way. It employs 30,000 or so developers, artists, and composers, and is unusually productive. The gross value add per video games worker is almost double the British average, according to government data. It's also a sector where Britain is leveling up. Almost four-fifths of video game developers work outside London. Clusters tend to form around successful early studios to reflect the sector's bedroom origins. Katie Good, a burgundy-haired rocket scientist turned games developer, runs her virtual reality studio from North Cornwall, one of the country's remotest corners. Hubs have emerged in places like Dundee, Leamington Spa, Slough, and Teesside. And AI may end up increasing the value of British developers rather than depleting it. It can boost productivity. At one studio in Brighton, a level that once took 90 days to build now takes just 10. Notes Nick Poole of UK Interactive Entertainment, an industry body. In a world of synthetic material and AI-generated content, this is a quote, the government's creative industry strategy correctly identifies that, quote, human endeavor and creativity will be more important than ever. The only way to mitigate the threat of AI is to tell great stories that haven't been told before, so notes Charles Cecil, creator of Broken Sword. What's exciting, he says, is that it is playing to British strengths. And with that, we come to the end of this week's reading of The Economist. This is SunSounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we've been reading from the August 16 through 22 edition of The Economist. Please join us again next week when we will again read from The Economist.